Today, who are some of the biggest enablers of image-based sexual abuse? Lisa Thompson of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation tells us.
Our day jobs involve not going after perpetrators of hands-on abuse, but it's a non-stop effort to go fight after men who wear suits and who have business degrees and run some of the world's biggest corporations that exist.
Then Bill Federer explains why silence in the face of evil is actually consent.
So I think it's going to be a rude awakening for all those church members who think they're being spiritual by not getting involved in politics. When they wake up and realize by their silence, they are giving consent to all that evil. They're inviting the judgment of God on their heads.
It's the weekend of October 19th and 20th. I'm Jeff Shambly, and this is The Stand Radio. Sexual exploitation can take many forms, and thanks to more sophisticated technology such as artificial intelligence, this kind of abuse is only getting worse. American Family Association has designated October as Pornography Awareness Month, and today we wanted to spend some time on the issue so that we can be prepared to fight against it. Lisa Thompson is the Vice President of the Research Institute for the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, and she's with us today to explain the dangers and solutions surrounding this problem. Ms. Thompson, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're talking about image-based sexual abuse. Can you give us a working definition of exactly what that is?
Yeah, of course. So today, many forms of sexual abuse and exploitation actually involve the use of images or videos that are exchanged online or posted online. So the term image-based sexual abuse refers to that, the sexual violation of a person that's committed by this, you know, the sharing and distribution, creation of images of them that depict them in some sort of sexual way, and into which they had no, they did not give meaningful consent to that use of their image in that way.
Back in August of this year, you had a conference where you addressed this issue, and there were some whistleblowers from some of the larger platforms such as Meta. What can you tell us about what we know is going on inside the minds of the leadership of some of these platforms?
Well, I've been involved in this field for over more than 20 years now. And when I first got involved in efforts to fight sexual abuse and exploitation, I really thought, you know, oh, we're trying to stop perpetrators. We're trying to prevent this problem from people going out there and committing hands-on offenses. But tragically, what's happened is that now our day jobs involve not going after perpetrators of hands-on abuse, but it's a non-stop effort to go fight after men who wear suits and who have business degrees and run some of the world's biggest corporations that exist. Like, it's astonishing that, you know, our day jobs are finding people with computer science degrees and business executives, but that's the case because the tech sector has so overwhelmingly become complicit in facilitating and fueling the behavior of those who are predators, whether they're committing now hands-on offenses or just engaging on these online offenses. So that the internet has just exploded the phenomenon of sexual abuse and exploitation, whether we're talking about children or adults as well. The tech industry is completely aware of this and for years did nothing about it. And it took organizations like ours, the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, to devote countless hours of staff time to researching what's going on these platforms, creating detailed reports and sending them letters. So we're really trying to shine a spotlight on them. But then they like to play, you know, they often plead ignorance. But then they, you know, basically we're doing their job for them. What they should already be doing is, you know, their due diligence of making sure that their products aren't harmful and aren't fueling sexual abuse and exploitation. But they unfortunately just have not stepped up to the plate and acted in a responsible way. So we've had to take on that role. You mentioned Meta in particular. We recently had our Coalition to End Sexual Exploitation Global Summit. And one of our speakers was a man by the name of David Erb. Now, David had, or I should say Mr. Erb, had worked for YouTube for quite some time and was very instrumental in helping YouTube get child sexual abuse material off the platform so that it wasn't being, you know, coming up in recommendations, that it wasn't on there. So they were acting, you know, actually taking proactive steps to get it off, which that is, it's just such an anomaly to hear, but that was wonderful. So he had that experience. And then he was recruited by Meta, I guess, Facebook, Meta, whatever you want to call them. And he came on board with them. And he told the story of how he had expected the same type of environment there, because he was given this task to make sure that child sexual abuse material wasn't available on Facebook. And what they found was, he said, quite frightening. They were finding a lot of material, a lot of stuff going on. He and his small team worked really hard to come up with a plan to try to deal with this problem. And in short, they were completely shut down. They did nothing. They've basically just rolled out the red carpet for child exploiters by adopting end-to-end encryption. And the upshot of it all was that David Erb resigned from Facebook. And it was really inspiring to hear that somebody cared enough to actually quit their job. You know, he could have just gone on and really kudos to him.
Lisa, could you give our listeners one or two things that they can do? Because on your website, endsexualexploitation.org, you have a number of things. And I would encourage people to visit that website, share it with your church members, your family, and your coworkers. But Lisa, give us a couple of things that our listeners can do to sort of push back against this.
Right. Well, definitely, I encourage people to visit our website and check out the Dirty Dozen list. That would be one of the places I would start, because that list the various corporations and other entities that are really hotbeds of allowing these kinds of exploitation to happen online. And I think some parents would be really surprised by some of the entities that they see there, places that their kids might be regularly going to. So you need to go there, educate yourself about who these companies are, what they're doing, and read about the evidence. And then we provide ways that you can take action, whether it's, you know, signing a petition or an email, sending an email to the company. That's one of the, you know, really constructive ways people can get involved, is just by visiting the Dirty Dozen list, making sure that you follow it. So, like, you know, maybe sign up for our email so that when the new Dirty Dozen list comes out in next spring, that you'll be the first to get the news and you can join in right away to alert, you know, send emails and petitions. Some petitions will go to Congress, some will go to the emails go to the companies, but trying to create that public pressure to know that we're tired of this. Like, it's been decades of this type of stuff, and it is time for it to stop. And we've got to do this to keep our kids safe.
The website, once again, endsexualexploitation.org. We encourage you to check out that website. Our guest has been Lisa Thompson, the Vice President of the Research Institute for the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Lisa, thank you for your tireless work. You and your team, I know you've done a tremendous amount. It seems an insurmountable obstacle to climb and to battle, but thank you for your work. And we'll be in prayer for you all, and hopefully we can make a dent in this epidemic.
Thank you so much. It's been so nice talking with you, and we just are so grateful for your concern, your shared concern.
In America's culture war, there's an uncomfortable polarization of values and beliefs. In that kind of atmosphere, it can be uncomfortable for Christians to speak out, but is silence really an option? Joining me is William J. Federer, a nationally known speaker, best-selling author, and president of a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. He's a frequent guest on American Family Radio, and his latest book is titled Silence Equals Consent, The Sin of Omission, Speak Now or Forever Lose Your Freedom. Bill Federer, thanks for being with us today.
Great to be with you.
This book has just come out earlier this year. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, I did a two-hour special with George Barna, and he went through the numbers. And Basically, you have millions of Americans who don't vote, and many races are determined by relatively small percentages of voters. And they, the estimates are there's 300 plus million people in America, 80 million identify as Christians, half of those aren't registered. And of those that are registered, half of those don't vote. So we're down to 20 million.
Wow.
And if just a few more percentages of Christians could vote, we could turn around the entire nation overnight. But they have gotten into this concept of, well, we don't want to get involved, or, you know, our kingdom's not of this world, or somehow I'm holy by not getting involved in, but we just preach the gospel. We don't get involved in politics. And it concerns me. And so I wanted to trace the roots of these. And so in the book, I go through the most common form of government in world history is kings. Nimrod, Pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsar. A king's just a glorified gang leader. It's a hierarchical system. You're friends with the king, you're more equal. You're not friends with the king, you're less equal. You're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. And kings rule through fear. The mandates. You do what they say or they kill you. The first instance of a nation that ruled itself without a king was ancient Israel. Around 1400 BC, they came out of Egypt, millions of Israelites, and there's no king for 400 years. It's called the Hebrew Republic. It works because every citizen is taught the law and they are personally accountable to God to follow the law. So you're about to steal, nobody's around, and then you think, God's watching me. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable. Maybe I should hesitate stealing. Creates a tiny thing in your head called a conscience. If everybody in the country believes this, you can maintain order with no police, with no king. But after 400 years, the Israelites said, we want to be like the other countries. We want a king, and they got King Saul. Why is this story important? The kings of Europe looked to the Bible for their authority, but they looked to the King Saul and on part of the Bible. The Calvinist Puritans and Baptist Presbyterians, Quakers that founded the colonies in America looked to the pre-King Saul part of the Bible. Both of them are looking to the Bible. One's pre-King Saul, the other's post-King Saul. Why is this important? Romans 13 is understood differently in a monarchy versus a republic. Romans 13, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. In a monarchy, subjects submit to the king. In a republic, the citizens are the king.
Yeah.
The politicians are your servants, public servants. You tell them what to do. And so subjects submit and citizens give consent. And so the 1600s in America, you had literally churches founding cities. You have Roger Williams, a pastor, and the first Baptist church in America founds a city, Providence, Rhode Island. And Reverend Thomas Hooker and the first Congregationalist church in America founds a city, Hartford, Connecticut. Everybody's involved in church. Everybody's involved in city government because it's the church founding the city. There's like no non-church members tagging along to be lazy and let them run everything. Every single politician is a church member because it's the church founding the city. And so when the revolution starts, the British send over a military governor, Thomas Gage, and he outlaws meeting houses. We don't need the people meeting and giving your consent to stuff. You just obey government mandates. And we're like, no, nothing happens in America unless we give our consent. He's like, no, you're a robot. You're a zombie. You just obey government. We're like, no, nothing happens unless we give our consent. Turns into a revolutionary war and we win. And we set up a government where it's we, the people, government for the consent of the governed. They got their ideas from these New England pastors who got it from the Bible. What part of the Bible? That first 400 years out of Egypt before King Saul.
That is a crucial distinction, because in conversations that I've had on Romans 13, it's almost seen like, no, this is what the authority says. This is what the church is going to do because they are the authority and we don't want to rebel against God. But what you've just described is a crucial distinction between the American Republican form of government and monarchy. And I think that's crucial to this conversation. So thank you for bringing that up. Bill, there are some people who want to remain neutral in the battle over values. What does the Bible say about remaining silent in the face of crucial decisions?
Right. So this goes to the 1700s and revivals by the Pietists. And these are people that started in Germany, and they said, look, when kings were deciding what was going to be believed in their kingdom. And they would say, look, it's more than just believing doctrine. You have to have an experience with Jesus. And when you do, your life will change and you won't do worldly things anymore, like bars and brothels and government.
Mm.
Wait, what was that last thing? Yeah, government. It's worldly. If you're really Christian, you won't get involved. So where the Puritans said, hey, everybody get involved in city government, everybody get involved in church, the Pietists are like, no, no, no. You have to withdraw from worldly things like government. Turn into the German concept of the two kingdoms, kingdom of the government, kingdom of the church, the two don't touch. It's where they say, well, if you're really Christian, you won't get involved in government. Well, who's left to be involved then?
Yeah.
But the non-Christians, the unholy, and since they're unholy, they're going to yield to their ambitions and turn into tyrants. And it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. Don't get involved in government because it's worldly. Well, why is it worldly? Because we're not involved in government. All the Christians have withdrawn themselves. Like, duh. And 4 centuries of that teaching in Germany allowed Hitler to seize power, put Jews on train cars. They're going right past the church, and the church's response was, well, that's the government that's killing the Jews. And we're the church, and we can't get involved in government stuff because we're holy. Mm. It's like, can anybody see there's something wrong with that picture? And so to those that think they're somehow holy by not getting involved, what do you do with Numbers chapter 30? It's the silence equals consent chapter. Short chapter, half a dozen scenarios. One, if a daughter is still living in her father's house in her youth and binds herself with a vow, the day the father hears it, if he is silent, her vows stand. But if he disallows it, she's released from the vow. That's come down to us as vows in a wedding ceremony. And the pastor tells the church members, if you are silent when you hear these vows, you're giving your consent. Speak now, forever hold your peace. And so if a church member's silence gives consent to wedding vows, it gives consent to other things. And if they're killing babies in the community and the church members are silent, those church members are giving their consent to killing babies. It's called the rule of tacit admission, T-A-C-I-T. It's in real estate law. You save up money, buy a rent house for some retirement income, and a squatter moves in. Mm-hmm. And if you know about it and don't try to charge them rent or evict them, they can gain title to your rent house. It's called adverse possession, just by you being silent.
Wow.
It's in trademark law. You design a trademark, somebody copies it, it's all over the internet. If you don't try to defend your trademark, everybody gets to use it. It's in debt collection law. Somebody owes you money, you wait 10 years to try to start collecting. The judge will say you've been silent too long, you're past the statute of limitations. It's in our Constitution, Article 1, Section 7. Congress puts a bill on the president's desk. If any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days, the same shall be a law in like manner as if he had signed it. All he has to do is be silent for 10 days, and his silence equals a signature. And so they have a tactic. It's to guilt trip Christians into being more Christian than Christ. Hmm. You say, what? They say, yeah, if you're really a Christian, you'll be silent while we teach your kids a sexual agenda that Jesus would never teach. I mean, would Jesus teach the trans agenda? You can be a boy today, a girl. You can be a furry. We know what Jesus taught, Matthew 19. He who made them at the beginning made them male and female. And so they're telling you, I mean, here are school counselors who cannot even define woman. Yet they think they can tell that a little boy is supposed to be a little girl. You can't even define girl. It's totally illogical. And Jesus said, if you allow one of these little ones who trust in me to fall into sin, it will be better for you to be thrown into the sea with a millstone around your neck. So I think it's going to be a rude awakening for all those church members who think they're being spiritual by not getting involved in politics. When they wake up and realize by their silence, they are giving consent to all that evil. They're inviting the judgment of God on their heads.
Our guest today is William J. Federer, author of the book Silence Equals Consent, The Sin of Omission, Speak Now or Forever Lose Your Freedom. Can you give us a sense of what you believe is at stake in this coming election just in a few short days?
Yeah, well, a judgment if we don't get involved. God's a just God. And there's nothing more unjust than killing innocent babies. And then there's sex trafficking. Jim Caviezel did a movie and on Sound of Freedom, and there's a line in there that sex trafficking is the new cocaine. Smuggle cocaine in, you sell it once, but smuggle a kid in, you can sell them 10 times a day. It's horrible. And church members are silent. There was a bill in California. Sharon Grove introduced it to make purchasing a child for sex a felony versus a misdemeanor with 2 days in jail. And it gets voted down. And Susan Eggman, a Democrat state senator, rebukes her own party. She says, I'm a social worker. I've worked with women who've been abused as children. They get wounded. They have to deal with it. And you're more concerned about this guy that's going to go out and do it again in 2 days. And where's the church? You know, the Salvation Army was started by William and Catherine Booth rescuing children out of sex trafficking. In London, they'd go to a poor family. Give us your daughter. We'll give her an education. As soon as they get her out of the house, they sell her to a brothel. Catherine Booth said when she found out, I felt as though I must go into the streets and besiege the dens where these hellish iniquities are going on. To keep quiet seemed like being a traitor to humanity. I mean, where's the church? Oh, we don't want to get involved in politics. They're selling children. Oh, we don't want to get involved. They're killing Jews. Oh, we don't want to get involved. It's like, I think God, whether we turn it around or not, I think God is pushing the world to a decision-making moment so that people will show what's really in their heart. And if they can be silent when and give their approval, their tacit approval to mutilating children and selling them, I wonder if the Spirit of God is really on the inside of them.
Yeah. You quote George Soros in your book as saying the main obstacle to a stable and just world is the United States. And of course, George Soros is the billionaire liberal who's really for open borders. What does George Soros mean when he says the United States is the obstacle to a stable and just world?
Right. So Soros, Klaus Schwab, World Economic Forum, they want a one world government. Brock Chisholm was the first director of the World Health Organization. Many people have heard of the World Health Organization. Brock Chisholm said, to achieve world government, it is necessary to remove from the minds of men their national patriotism. Huh. So globalists do not want people to be patriotic to their nation. And so they want to malign them and call them Christian nationalists. Well, nationalism is, in a sense, the opposite of globalism. I mean, and then the second is nationalism is good or bad depending on the nation. In socialist nations, nationalism is bad. Like Nazi stands for National Socialist Workers Party. Why? Because there's no individual rights. Ask the Jews. Well, we believe in individual rights from a creator, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly. And we're all equal. And to top it all off, it's government from the consent of the governed. How can a nation get any better than that? You have rights the government cannot take away. Everyone is equal, and you're in charge, government from the consent of the governed. So nationalism is bad in socialist and Islamist nations because there's no individual rights. But we're a country dedicated to individual rights. We want to preserve our nation. And finally, Christian nationalism used to be called Christian patriotism. It wasn't until 2006 that you began to see the term Christian nationalism being used. Prior to that, it was all Christian patriotism. Hmm. And you had Lincoln's inaugural address where he said, intelligence, patriotism, Christianity are still competent to adjust in the best way all our present difficulty. Lincoln mentions patriotism and Christianity right next to each other in his inaugural. The country was always predominantly Judeo-Christian and patriotic, but the globalists don't like that, and so they want to deride and So it's important for us to not be swept up and realize that whether we turn it around or not, the good Lord is pulling back the curtain so that you can see the evil, so that you're forced to have to show what's in your heart. And there are those that are doing evil, those that are silent in the face of evil, and by their silence, they're giving their consent to it. And there are those that are saying, you know what, I was silent for a long time, and then I stretched the rubber band and tolerated something else. But I can't be silent when they want to do a hysterectomy on a little 8-year-old girl because she went through a tomboy phase. I'm sorry, I can't be silent when they want to castrate a little boy because he played with his sister's dolls and they cut the rubber band and it snaps. And I think God is pushing the world to this snapping, this divide, like a cell divides. And we're the bride of Christ. Every romance novel builds up to a decision-making moment, a forsaking of all others and choosing the one. I think some people are going to choose the all others. They're going to want to be liked and friended. Some were going to follow Jesus, but they didn't want to do so because they were afraid of being put out of the synagogue because they love the praises of men more than the praises of God.
Yeah, it's almost like the statement that Joshua issued, choose you this day who you will serve, whether you will serve the Lord or the gods of this land. You know, that is a crucial point to bring out. You are a walking encyclopedia when it comes to history and church history. Are there any periods in history that you would point to that illustrate the church's role in determining a nation's moral trajectory?
Definitely. You know, you go back to Rome, it was pagan, and then the Christians got saved, and they got involved and began to stop the Colosseum events where they would, fight to the death. And the Romans had exposure of unwanted infants. And so, you know, the stories of, oh, there's a knock on the door of an old couple and they have a baby in a basket. Who leaves babies in a basket? The Romans. It was their version of abortion. And the early Christian says, we can't be silent. So they would begin to collect these children and raise them. And then they had temple prostitutes. And so the Christians were ones speaking out against that. And then the Christians eventually got rid of slavery. And so it was this gradual spreading of doing to others as you would have them doing to you. And so this is something that we have to realize, Deuteronomy 28, blessings and cursings. If you hearken to the voice of the Lord, you'll be the head, not the tail, and so forth. But if you don't hearken to the voice of the Lord, it says the stranger will come in amongst you and rise up above you, and they'll be the head and you'll be the tail, and you'll be a debtor, and the diseases will come upon you. And so God's a just God. He can put off the judgment if we repent, like when Josiah, that king, his granddad Manasseh, was sacrificing children to Molech, but this king Josiah repented. He rends his heart, and the judgment's put off for 31 years. And so I'm praying that we have a Josiah generation, and we rend our hearts and repent and get involved. You know, I mentioned every romance novel builds up to a decision-making moment, but imagine some people say, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to wait for the rapture. I have a question. Who do you think you're going to meet when you're raptured? Jesus. Does Jesus love the little children? Oh, yes, Jesus loves the little children. Do you think he might wonder why you didn't do anything to protect him? I mean, we're not in North Korea or China. We're in America, where the citizen is the king. Some people say, well, God, I'm not going to do anything, but God knows my heart. It's like, well, he knew Abraham's heart, but he still wanted to see Abraham do something, take his son Isaac. You know, imagine a guy watching football. And you say, when was the last time you told your wife you love her? And he's like, I can't remember, but she knows my heart. It's like, okay. When was the last time you did anything to show your wife you love her? I can't remember, but she knows my heart. It's like, dude, we need to have a little marriage counseling here. People say, God knows my heart. Yes, he does. And he wants to hear some words out of your mouth, and he wants to see some actions.
Yeah. Well, it's good. Like James says in chapter 4, verse 17, therefore to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. So it comes down to what we do, not merely what we believe. William J. Federer, our guest today, author of the book Silence Equals Consent, The Sin of Omission, Speak Now or Forever Lose Your Freedom. It's a great book. We encourage you to check it out at christianbook.com, and also Bill Federer's website, americanminute.com. When you go to americanminute.com, you'll find lots of resources, videos, and many other things to encourage you in your Christian walk. William Federer, thank you for being with us on the Stan Radio. Thank you for writing this book at this crucial time in our history.
Thank you.
Next week, with the Christmas season on the way, we'll talk to the pastor of a Texas church who overcame a massive hurricane in 2017 and went on to pack over 8,000 shoeboxes for Operation Christmas Child. And what's amazing is the church has less than 50 members. Today's program is available as a podcast at AFR.net, and a free 6-month trial subscription to The Stand magazine can be yours at AFA.net/The Stand. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Stand Radio.